the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, welcome to a special episode of the What Bitcoin Did podcast with an update on the political crisis in Venezuela. I've recorded a show about Venezuela previously with Alejandro Macedo, and I've invited him back on the podcast today with Giancarlo Fiorello and Mauricio Bartolomeo. I may have pronounced their names wrong, so if I have, I do apologize for that. Listen, there's no ads on this show. This is a special release. I just wanted to get out there. I just wanted to have an update on kind of what's happening in the political crisis, because I know a lot of people who listen to my podcast are interested in what's happening in Venezuela. So yes, I hope this is useful. If you do have any questions, do feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi there, all of you. How are you all? And also, thank you all for giving up some time to come on my podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. Glad to be here.
Great. So before we start, I think it would be a good idea for everyone to find out very quickly who you are, what your background is, and what your relevance is to what is happening right now in Venezuela. So Alejandro, you've been on the show before. You can kick off.
Yes. Thank you, Peter. Well, it's great to be here, as always. My name is Alejandro Machado. I'm currently researching how people are using cryptocurrency in Venezuela, and also how people in general are using money there, hoping to get some good insights so that people can design products and we could nudge the industry more in that direction to the people that need it the most. We believe that places where there's lack of economic freedoms are the places where we should focus, as that's the community. And we're trying to get real data and real like insights from these people and from these societies. And of course, being from Venezuela, it's the place where I focus and the place that really drives me up. That's what I'm excited about. So I'm doing some field research at the moment, and I'll have stuff to share in a couple months.
Giancarlo?
So thanks again, Peter, for having me on. If you told me a week ago that I was going to be on a Bitcoin podcast, I would have said you were crazy, because I don't know the first thing about Bitcoin. I've never been interested in it, but I'm really happy to be here and talk about something I do know a little bit about, which is the Venezuelan situation. So as you mentioned, my name is Giancarlo Fiorella. I'm a doctoral candidate at the Center for Criminology and Sociolegal Studies at the University of Toronto. I'm writing a dissertation broadly on protest policing, and I'm interested in particular in the policing of protests by civilians. If you're familiar with the situation in Venezuela, there are civilian groups that will occasionally turn up at anti-government protests, and they're a kind of a police or sort of a militia. You know, there's some discussion about our militaries. And so that's, we'll say, the case study that I'm focusing on for my dissertation. And I've just recently started working as an investigator and trainer for Latin America at Bellingcat, which is something that I'm really excited about. And I've also been running a sort of like a Venezuelan news website for the last 5 years. So every day I read the news from Venezuela. I sort of piece together a summary of what happened in the day. I translate it into English, and I also provide context for an English-speaking audience. So for people who live in Canada like I do, and who, you know, they might not be too familiar with what's going on, but my hope is that they go to my website and they understand a little bit more about what's happening day to day in Venezuela.
And Mauricio, with yours, can you also tell the story of what happened with, was it your brother's mining farm?
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit about that. My name is Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. I'm from Venezuela and now based in Canada. I have been in Venezuela. My whole family was still very much in Venezuela until a couple of years ago. We started mining in Venezuela in around 2014. And as mining started picking up popularity in Venezuela, a lot of other Venezuelans wanted to learn about it and do it because it was a great way for them to earn an income. A lot of people were very secretive around how, you know, you could set up a mining operation and basically how to purchase the equipment and install it. But we didn't really take that route. We were pretty much an open book to anyone that came and wanted to learn how to mine. So we helped, I think it's in the neighborhood of hundreds, like 500 people, got set up one way or another. And as we became more known in the Bitcoin community, around the 2017 Christmas, when Maduro announced the Petro, he kind of created this informational campaign to let people know what mining machines looked like, what they did. And that prompted some of the corrupt police to basically start raiding facilities illegally and try to extort miners. That happened to us in December 2017. We had a brigade knock down a door and start harassing my brother, threatening him with jail, took his equipment, accused him of terrorism. It was a really terrible situation. So we all left. I mean, my family actually ended up leaving from that point. I was already in Canada. And along with these other two gentlemen here, we're all from Venezuela, and we've kind of witnessed the entire system fall apart. And a lot of us that discovered Bitcoin through it saw in Bitcoin a way out, or perhaps a way to alleviate some of the pain. And since then, I've been focusing in Canada and setting up Ledin, which is a Bitcoin-backed lender, as a first product. And the idea there is to bring fair price North American standard financial services using Bitcoin as a vehicle to places like Venezuela.
Okay, great. So thank you for all coming on. I've had a previous show about Venezuela, which I ran with Alejandro. And obviously, there's been quite a change in the political climate recently. Before we look into that, Alejandro, could you just, for anyone listening, kind of give a very short summary of what has happened over the last 20 years in Venezuela, from pre-Chavez to Chavez to Maduro, so people can get an understanding of the general breakdown in society in Venezuela?
I was 9 years old when Chavez came to power. So it's Chavismo is the only government that I've ever really known. Before that, I wasn't obviously paying much attention to politics, or politics wasn't really a key part of Venezuelan life. This is the main thing that Chavismo has done. It has polarized society in a way that you need to care about politics because everything is in danger. So Chavez came to power in 1999 first, and he came to power with a mandate to step aside from old style politics, to end corruption, to find like a third way between capitalism and socialism. That's the way he sold himself to the electorate. And many people, especially in the left around the world, championed Chavez for a very long time, even after he was displaying some clear authoritarian tendencies, because the left, I believe, tends to be more tolerant of these tendencies. And even though there are warning signs, for example, Human Rights Watch failed to spot these warning signs in, I think, as late as 2006, 2007. So even human rights organizations weren't really catching on to what was really going on. Chavez slowly eroded the institutions of the country. So he gradually took over the National Assembly, which was parliament, but then or Congress, but then he started changing names. He started making everything about the Bolivarian Revolution. So he played a lot with symbols, and a lot with he tried to decree reality in a way, and he succeeded somewhat because he had access to the world's or at least the region's most bountiful mineral wealth ever in the history of Venezuela, and probably in the history of Latin America. There hasn't ever been a time better for economic extraction of resources, which in Venezuela's case is oil, as when Chavez was ruling over Venezuela. So much of that was squandered away. There was a lot of corruption. There was a lot of favoring government contractors. There was a lot of loyalists who were there only because they could get ahead, or they could get rich by just being close to power. So Chavez's government was always a government that favored loyalty over competence. And that was deadly for the oil company that's state-run and has been state-run since the 70s in Venezuela. And basically, I think the best way to describe it is a kleptocracy. It's just a very, very bad way to run government. It's just rewarding loyalty and rewarding corruption. There were many bad incentives throughout the presidency. And then when Chavez died, he appointed Maduro as his successor. So people voted for him because he still had a lot of charisma and a lot of people who followed him just because of the coincidence of the oil bounty, right? And then Maduro came to power, and he didn't have the same kind of charisma. So he had to become more authoritarian and more abusive to be able to keep the population in line. There were protests from as early as 1 year after Maduro got elected. In 2014, there were big massive protests, and we saw the first real like violence in the streets, and probably Giancarlo can expand more on this. Just started to see the ramp up of a police state and of a state that censors the internet, for example, a state that is way more fierce about capital controls and about controlling the money and issuing more and more money, printing more money. So this has devolved in a full-fledged economic crisis that has the country, you know, in one of its worst shapes ever. Poverty is now at more than 90%, which when Chavez came to power, it was around 45. So it's more than doubled. And the situation is very dire because it's now being compounded by the hyperinflation, which and the government now with the latest standoff between the international community who backs the who should be the president, the caretaker president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. He is this figure came to prominence just like 3 weeks ago. Maduro's term ended, and there weren't clear, fair, and free elections last year. He just staged some fake elections like Cuba's or North Korea's. The world looked and said, you know, these aren't real elections. Like we won't accept the outcome of these elections. But Maduro thought he could get away with it, so he tried to swear himself in. But then the Constitution of Venezuela has some mechanisms to solve that problem. When there's a void in the presidency because of any reason, and one of these reasons could be that the president just failed, like there failed to be elections, then the president of the National Assembly of Congress is the one who should take power temporarily for some days so that free and fair elections can be organized and then the country can get back on its feet. And this is what happened. And now we have this situation where besides the huge economic crisis, there's also a big political crisis that some, like most of the international community and most of the Western countries are recognizing Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela. And there he has his ambassadors. He's been trying to, keep that international influence and trying to, for example, capitalize on seize the assets that rightfully belong to the republic in the United States and in other places. And on the other hand, you have Maduro, who has still the backing of the high command of the military. It's not clear whether he has the backing of most of the military. It's just a matter of coordination, right? So, but Maduro is deeply unpopular in all of the Venezuelan population. More than 85% of the people don't approve of Maduro. They don't want Maduro in power, and they believe he's illegitimate. But here we are. There's a standoff between, you know, the internal security forces and military, who, again, have been very loyal and have a lot of incentives to support Maduro and his rule of corruption, and the citizens who really just want to get out of this.
Mauricio, could you just give me an understanding of what it is actually like for people at the moment living in Venezuela? I think it's almost impossible for somebody living in a country like where I am in the UK to understand what it's like to live under hyperinflation. We hear anecdotal stories of people running around shops repricing items, but the actual reality of living in Venezuela at the moment, operating a business and trying to feed your family, can you give me some reality behind that?
Living in Venezuela is a very challenging feat right now. It is not what you would expect when you think of normal life in your North American or European countries. Money is a big problem. I'm sure Alejandro can comment on this based on the research that he's running. But just the sole idea of getting paid in something that you need to get rid of is a huge problem. So as a Venezuelan right now, if I get a paycheck today, what I have to do is immediately get on my phone and try to find somebody that will sell me some dollars. At any price, really, because the price at this point is changing so quickly that you really just need to get rid of them. There's no sense in you waiting for a better moment to buy dollars. It's always the best moment to get dollars is when you have bolívares. So people go into this frenzy trying to get rid of their bolívares so they can acquire dollars. it's very difficult to store these dollars. You keep them in cash, or you basically deposit it in someone's account that is not yours, because not everybody has access to US dollar accounts. That seems like a normal thing here, but for a Venezuelan citizen with a conflict passport, it is impossible or very difficult to go out in any country nowadays and get a US dollar denominated account. So you're constantly trying to get rid of your bolívares, and it's to the point now where at shops and restaurants, will they would actually take US credit cards. And that is the most common way to pay right now, is sending Zelle transfers and actually making credit card payments. An interesting anecdotal story that I just, from a friend that I was recently chatting with, one common way right now to make currency arbitrage. So currency arbitrage, just by the sheer fact that everyone is always buying and selling dollars, and this is a constant need, there is an opportunity for people to come in and play arbitrage, and they become the market makers. Because there is no central market, everything is a black market. So there are these hubs of liquidity, and people have stepped in, and they are the market makers. So effectively, one way that people are basically getting an arbitrage opportunity today is they will go to a restaurant or a shop that has accumulated a significant amount of bolívares during that day. That company itself doesn't want to deposit it in the bank, because just taking it to the bank, finding another seller, and then sending off those bolívares is very difficult. There's a lot of restrictions on the amounts of your transfers. So what you do is you essentially, using a Square or some sort of credit card point of sale device, you will run someone's US credit card. You will give them a bulk discount for taking all of your bolívares. And then that person goes off and starts piecing out the bolívares in smaller amounts to other people. And that's how they make arbitrage today. Before, it used to be more in a straight buying and selling of dollars in the black market, and they would make a spread. But now it's becoming a lot more complicated to do it. And an interesting note is that, we can get into this maybe later, but a dollar worth of Bitcoin is trading at a premium to a dollar in Venezuela. And this premium has been sustained for the better half of this year, which I believe is largely a function of the government of Venezuela printing and dumping the freshly printed cash in the P2P Bitcoin market.
So, Giancarlo, January 23rd, a new wave of protests started, right? And as I understand, there's always protests in Venezuela, but this was a specific wave on a specific date for a specific reason. So can you give us a background to why these protests started, what the background was, and an update on the current political situation in Venezuela?
Sure, yeah. As you said, protests are relatively common in Venezuela, and they certainly were. Even last year, we saw a huge wave of healthcare worker protests that started, spontaneously as a result of the healthcare crisis, and they were pretty sustained. We were talking about weeks and weeks of protests at hospitals from nurses and doctors, etc. But as you mentioned, this is a different sort of event, because this was what happened on the 23rd was as you say, a planned protest. January 23rd is an important day in Venezuelan history, because it's the anniversary of when we kicked out one of our previous dictators through protests. So it's an important date in the imagination of the Venezuelan state, I guess, and the Venezuelan people. It's the day when we, some generations ago decided, we've had enough of the dictatorship, let's get them out. So as Alejandro mentioned earlier, so Juan Guaido is the president of the National Assembly. He became president of the National Assembly in early January. Every year there's a new legislative term, and there's a whole new legislative assembly that is elected with a new president, executive committee, etc. So this year it just happened to have been Juan Guaido. So right when he's sworn in as the president of the National Assembly in early January, there's a lot of rumors and expectations that they're going to make a big move, because, as Alejandro mentioned, the presidential election from last year was not free, fair, and it was rigged. So Maduro basically stole this election. You know, he banned major opposition parties from running. He banned individuals from running against them, right? So it was a completely sort of a sham of an election. So Maduro wins that election. And then he's supposed to be sworn in January. So early January, lots of expectation, because one of the things that the National Assembly can do is, as Alejandro mentioned, declare the presidency vacant. So say, for a list of reasons, we actually don't have a president. So in that case, according to Article 233 of the Constitution, the National Assembly president becomes interim president. It's supposed to be for a period of 30 days until we have elections to elect a new permanent president. So all of these things are happening in early January. Maduro is supposed to be sworn in, Guaido's coming in as president of the National Assembly, and there's lots of expectation, lots of rumors that this is going to happen in early January, and it doesn't. And I remember back then there was some disappointment I heard, you know, just from following the news and from hearing what people are saying, you know, in talk shows and whatnot, that, you know, that Guaido sort of missed his chance and he should have done it. Why hasn't he declared the presidency vacant? Why hasn't he, you know, taken on the responsibilities given to him in Article 233? And so on the 23rd is when that happened. I personally wasn't expecting it. I was watching the protest on a live stream. And I wasn't expecting Guaido to do that. I don't know if many people were, but it was a really shocking moment. So he was speaking at a rally in Caracas. There was tons of people out on the street. It was the biggest demonstration since 2017. And he swore the oath. He said, you know, he invoked Article 233. He said, I'm becoming the interim president. And that just completely flipped over the political dynamic in Venezuela, because now we have two presidents. Which is something that, you know, usually doesn't end well for a country, right? Like it could lead to much worse things, right? To like a complete fracturing of the state. And so the situation right now is that I think we're seeing that fracture develop. One of the things that the opposition has done in conjunction with Guaido becoming interim president is that it's passed an amnesty bill. And this bill is supposed to cover any government officials, including soldiers, who have committed crimes in the past, if they help. I believe the word if they collaborate with restoring democratic order in Venezuela, they could receive amnesty afterwards. Right. So this is a big push that the opposition is making here, because they're trying to basically convince the army and, you know, civil servants in general, you know, entire institutions, ministries, to just sort of abandon Maduro and flip. So that's an initiative that's also taking place right now. And so what we're seeing right now is an attempt, a really open attempt to really fracture the state, to say, you know, abandon Maduro. He's not the legitimate president. He's a dictator. Come join the democratic forces, the people who really have the legitimacy to run. And we're also seeing that play out. We haven't seen it play out in the army. We can talk about that later if you'd like. The army so far, there's been individual defections. Most recently, a member of the Air Force High Command defected. I believe he's the highest ranking member of the army to abandon Maduro. But what I was talking about, the fracturing of the state, we're seeing that also in international diplomacy, which is really interesting. So Guaido has been appointing ambassadors to countries that already have ambassadors that were appointed by Maduro. So places like the United States, Colombia, a lot of Latin American countries. So then, you know, really quickly, this becomes really confusing, because now you have like, you have two presidents, now you have like two different sets of diplomats. And so, you know, if you can imagine, you're England, you know, or you're Germany or Spain or the United States, who do you talk to? You know, that's affecting financing, of course. So the situation today is complicated, to say the least.
And one more thing in there, Giancarlo, could you help us understand a little bit about the relationship between the army and Maduro? Because I've read conflicting reports that he has the support of the army, but I've also read that he is essentially a stooge of the army, and the army itself is a criminal organization involved in drug trafficking, smuggling of gasoline out of the country. So is there a clear direction of what the relationship is? And could you also explain what are the risks of defection? Because I guess you can't defect from within. You've kind of got to like almost like sneak away, right?
So the relationship between the military and Maduro is a really interesting one. A couple of years ago, Maduro created a company called Caminpeg, And it's a company that is run by the Ministry of Defense. So the head of this organization is the Minister of Defense, and he appoints the executive board. And this company was given complete control over anything to do with resource exploration or exploitation in Venezuela. So anything to do with like oil, minerals, etc. Right. So when this company was created, a lot of commentators said, "Okay, this is it. This is Maduro handing over the wealth of the country, and Venezuela is overwhelmingly, almost entirely run on resources." And so they said, "Well, this is Maduro handing the military complete control, probably, you know, buying them off essentially." So that's where I think a lot of people say, like, you know, is Maduro really in charge, or is the military sort of just like keeping him in place because they're the ones who are actually calling the shots? So it is true, you know, that all of the money that comes into Venezuela really goes through this company, which is run by the military. So they have a really vested interest in maintaining the status quo. Alejandro also mentioned that, you know, when we say the military, I mean that the army is this big institution. I think it's important to stress that, you know, we're really talking, I think, about the high command, like the upper levels of the military are the ones that are, I think, squarely on the side of Maduro, because they're benefiting, you know, significantly and personally from these corruption schemes that have been in place for a while. And so that is as opposed to like an ordinary sort of like, you know, like a normal kind of soldier who's not getting paid on time, who whatever little he is getting paid is getting like melted away by the inflation, et cetera, right? To talk about corruption and like the drug cartel. Yeah. So there's this, it's sort of an open secret, I think. I mean, I think most people have heard this name, but it's not something that's been necessarily widely reported. There have been rumors for a while that there is a drug cartel operating inside the higher levels of the military. It's called the Cartel de los Soles. As far as I can tell, this organization actually predates Chavismo. It's been around, from the sources that I've seen, since at least the early 90s. But it's kind of an open secret. Like everybody will tell you like, yeah, of course, like the Cartel de los Soles is real, but nobody can, as far as they can tell, like it's really hard to pin down like, okay, like what does it actually look like? Who, you know, who runs it? Like what are the different branches of it? Right. So in that sense, I'm not sure that it's, this is my speculation. I don't know that it is a cartel, like we might think of like the Medellin cartel, you know, Pablo Escobar, right? It might just be like a loose association of people who have similar interests in like becoming rich, and they all happen to be in the army, right? It's also the case that there's tons of smuggling, as you said, particularly in the border region. So in any area bordering Colombia, for example, you know, there's gasoline smuggling out of Venezuela into Colombia, and you know, the smuggling of supplies from Colombia into Venezuela. That's you know, the military in those areas has a direct stake in that. So it's, again, you know, just to maybe summarize it, it's a complicated situation. It's a complicated relationship that Maduro has with the army. It's something that I've been thinking about, you know, recently. I think definitely Maduro is in power really because the army is refusing to switch sides, at least at the higher levels. And so in a sense, they're the ones who are really perpetuating the situation because they're refusing to switch sides. And in terms of the risks for defection, well, you know, last year there were dozens and dozens of soldiers, officers who were arrested for supposedly conspiring to overthrow Maduro, right? So the risks are potential, you know, I mean, they're clear. It is a fact that the army is intimidated into following, into sort of keeping in line, or else, you know. So it's something that I think does play a big role in maintaining Maduro in power.
Alejandro?
Yeah, I was going to say that the else might mean torture. It's not just like a, you know, if you get in trouble working for a Western government and you're in the military, even if you have like, if you're charged with treason or with like the most, you know, delicate or most serious crimes that you can get charged with in a Western country, you will not get tortured, most likely, right? Like, and in Venezuela, this is routine. Like, it happens all the time. People are very afraid of that. And also, they intimidate you, or they intimidate military officers with their families. Like, they they might tell them, you know, we're going to do something to your family. You're going to regret this. And it's not, it's something that goes way beyond what a normal Western government could do.
Mauricio?
No, I was just going to add, there's, you know, we this government is no fan or not a friend of anyone that, you know, questions it in any way. There was an episode last year where there was an uprising led by this gentleman called Oscar Perez, and they were actively surrendering. Literally, he put this whole thing on Instagram. They were actively surrendering because they were being outnumbered and shot at by the Venezuelan military, and they just assassinated them. They, you know, it's on record. They just went in and shot them, guys that were openly trying to surrender. There's been episodes where a political enemy was committed alleged suicide by the first day he was taken into questioning, jumping out of a 10-story balcony, which nobody believes. And so, yeah, it is very real. It is very referred to it as a terrorist state, personally, because it is they have this new body that they've created called the FAES, which is Fuerza Anti Extorsión y Secuestro, which is essentially this new body, security body that has an open license to go and shoot first and ask questions later.
They're this squad.
And these are the guys that they're that squad. And they're actually routinely, and Giancarlo and Alejandro can, you know, probably speak more to this, but they are routinely sent to the places where the protests happen the day after. So they basically tally up with anyone that was out there. So people are constantly under the threat of you know, becoming victims of all these horrible acts just by not supporting the government or openly opposing it.
Alejandro, there's a lot of reporting about what's happening in Venezuela at the moment, and depending on where you read, you can kind of get a different picture. There's almost some claims that this is an American coup. What are the truths and the myths that you're seeing in the reporting right now?
Yeah, I think the biggest blunder that I've seen, or the most common blunder, is the media is covering the crisis and is talking about Juan Guaido as self-appointed or self-sworn in, which is not the case. I think journalists should do a better job at researching how the Venezuelan constitution works and what the mechanisms are in case of, you know, when there weren't really free elections, when the National Assembly, which is the last standing democratic institution in Venezuela, which was elected in at the end of 2015, the opposition absolutely crushed the government in that election. And the government made really sure that they would never hold free or free-ish elections again. Even, you know, with all of the intimidation that the government routinely deploys, even before 2015, and all of the to voters, they create this fear of, oh, we're going to know who you voted for. And it's like in the system, technically, this is not possible, but people believe because this is an electronic system. So people don't really know how it works. And there's not a lot of really good technical literacy in Venezuela. So, I mean, sure, experts can say, yeah, this system is very good. It is tamper-proof and so on. It, you know, the system that we had until 2015. But the people don't know that. So they're very intimidated. And even though there was a lot of gerrymandering and electoral abuse, the opposition absolutely crushed the government as early as 2015 because they were sick and tired of Maduro. Like we knew where we were going, and there were already was already a lot of scarcity, and so that ended with the opposition taking power over Congress, which is it should be a powerful body. It should be able to make laws. It should be able to start changing the situation. But what the government did was just double down and then start eroding the institutions even more. They created a parallel parliament and so on. So I think most people that cover us in the media today, they don't have that context because they're just reacting to the crisis very quickly. And they just think they have this, obviously they have studied history of the United States intervention in other countries like in Nicaragua and in other parts of South and Central America. Pinochet and Allende, you know, all of that. And that creates like a trigger, and it maps very quickly to their, and especially if you sympathize with the left, it creates an association that is unfair. Like that said, anything that the US, you know, is pushing for in its international agenda looks like a coup to some people and looks like some sort of unwarranted intervention. And I think in this case, it's very different. This is a mechanism that is triggered by the Venezuelan constitution. It was started by the people of Venezuela. And all we ask is for the international community, governments, international media, and so on to report what's going on and to recognize that Maduro's term is over and we need some help in terms of international recognition to be able to really create the conditions of pressure so that the military, in fact, stops backing Maduro. Because if not, we can have a very difficult situation where there's a standoff between different military groups and where the military just favors the status quo because they are incentivized economically to do so. But they're not really, like, while the rest of the country withers and dies. So that is, I think, the biggest misconception. You know, like, they're describing this, oh, it's U.S.-led. It's not. There's actually a list of misconceptions that I can translate some of the tweets because it's in Spanish. I can send it to you later. There are some, like, common blunders there. But I think that's the one that bothers me the most. And then, yeah, just automatically thinking, yo, this is just another act of U.S. imperialism. This is exactly the same as Libya, exactly the same as the Middle East. Oh, they're in it for the oil. It's not true. The U.S. doesn't need Venezuelan oil. Venezuela needs the U.S. way more than the U.S. needs Venezuela. And that is clear from what the government has been. The government has actually suffered a lot in the past few days because they have lost control over key assets, especially U.S. assets. They have lost control over their gold in the Bank of England, which also we can also get into later. It's just, I think it's humbling, and I'm very satisfied with the response. I don't think we've ever seen a situation in the past where the international community, in especially countries that do care about human rights and democracy, they're standing up to this authoritarian government and saying, you know what, we no longer recognize you. Your term is up, and we are supporting the people of Venezuela, which is, I think, a very clear stance. And it's if you do support human rights, you have to be in this camp. If you, on the other hand, are more like China, which you're very pragmatic and you just care about doing business and you don't care how difficult the situation is or how human rights are respected in a country, then, of course, you won't have a problem supporting a criminal regime.
And Mauricio, would you say a better or more accurate picture of the U.S. situation is that they have a very good understanding of the situation in Venezuela and they have leverage to put the right kind of pressure on the Maduro regime with sanctions, and that will obviously then have a trickle effect across the world? I mean, historically, the strongest relationships for Venezuela or with the Maduro regime is China, Russia, and Turkey, as I understand it. A lot of Russian money has gone into China, but I was reading today that, sorry, a lot of Russian money has gone into Venezuela, but I was reading today that the Kremlin's gone pretty quiet on their relationship with Maduro. So would you say it's more that the U.S. has a better understanding of what's happening?
I do think the U.S., particularly led by the camps of Marco Rubio and a lot of the other Republicans, I guess, that have stood up for the Venezuelan cause, the Venezuelan diaspora in Miami is probably the strongest one globally. And they have been making a very, very big push to raise awareness in the U.S. Congress of what is actually happening. So it's been pretty surprising, really, to me to see how well they understand the situation. They really have taken the stance that this isn't the kind of party that you can negotiate with. There's been many attempts of having actual discussions and reach agreements to set new elections. The government, time and again, kicks the can and hurts the people. And so they've really now called the regime what it is, which is it's a criminal state. They're involved in all sorts of dark or shady businesses. And I think what they are doing is, you know, in my view, the right approach, because they are really just trying to choke Maduro out of financing and putting all the pieces in place so that the military can switch and trying at least to put through a change without any violence. right? And I think what the approach is that they're trying to do is they're trying to make the threat of actual, you know, either by bringing in foreign aid or by bringing in a group convoy to protect their embassies that are still there. They're just trying to elevate the levels of potential threat so that the ranking officers can now say, it's not worth it for me to keep supporting these guys. One thing that I really applaud Guaido in doing, which is something I think the Venezuelan opposition should have been doing a long time ago, is requesting calls and direct conversations with China and Russia, which have actually thrown lifelines to the Maduro regime time and again when they got put in corners. And I think it's time that someone just steps up to the plate and says to these guys, listen, we understand your situation. You're better off working with us than continuing to support this you know, criminal. So I think those are the right steps. And I have, you know, I will continue watching with a lot of interest to see how these things continue to escalate.
Giancarlo, what is the current state of the political climate today? What leverage and tools does Juan Guaido have at his disposal? And what is the expected kind of next steps within Venezuela?
So the next steps question is, a lot of people have been asking me about, like, what do you think is going to, it's really hard to tell. I'm going to give it my best shot because it is obviously a question on everybody's mind, including my own, but it is such an unprecedented and unpredictable situation that it's hard to say. I just want to jump in really quickly before I answer that question. Peter, my own sort of take on in particular the U.S. involvement is more cautious, I think, because I do think that we have to be very skeptical about any kind of foreign intervention in Venezuela, just precisely because this is such an important time in the history of the country that when you're at a crisis point, I think people have a tendency to sort of like jump to leaders and say, you know, like, let's do whatever these guys are doing, or let's follow this guy to the end. And I think we have to be, you know, cognizant of the fact that that's really partially why we're in this situation, or almost, you know, entirely, you could argue, because, you know, Venezuela in the late 1990s was us having a lot of problems, right? And then suddenly this guy shows up and he's got all the answers, right? And it's Hugo Chavez, right? So I think we have to be skeptical always, and in particular when we're in crisis points like the one today. So I don't think we should throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think that the international reaction has been excellent for the most part. I think that the diplomatic efforts that Guaido has been leading with the U.S., for example, like appointing, I guess, like a shadow diplomat, I think that's really good. You know, things like sanctions, like the sanctions against PDVSA, that the U.S. has put in place. I think those have, you know, the consensus that I've seen is that those are going to hurt in the you know, potentially even in the short term, they're going to hurt Venezuelan people. So those sorts of things, I think we have to be very careful with. And we just have to recognize that this is a really complicated situation, that there's a lot of moving parts, and that it is precisely because of that that we have to really ask lots of questions whenever somebody wants to get involved, even if they say that they want to help. And so to your question about sort of what are the next steps, what's Guaido doing politically, I think that the big developments over the last couple of days have been the blocking, as Alejandro was mentioning, the blocking of financial I don't know what we want to call it, access, I guess, of the Maduro government. That has the potential to, I think, completely undo him. And I think, you know, once the book on this is written, like, that might be a big chapter in it. Like, once government started to really get serious about, okay, we're not going to let this government access money anymore, I think that's going to be a big part of bringing the government down. You know, the opposite side of that coin is like, okay, so now if we're not going to let Maduro take that money, like, we should let, are we going to let Guaido take it, right? Like, are we going to let the Guaido interim government take it? I've heard some movement in that front. I'm not entirely sure how that's going to play out because, again, we're in an unprecedented moment where we really kind of have two governments emerging, right? And in terms of next steps concretely, the big thing that's happening right now is that there's a humanitarian relief I don't know if you want to call it a convoy or effort that's being organized out of three countries in the region. So we know Colombia is one of them. The other one is Brazil. And the other one, from the latest reports that I saw, was an island in the Caribbean. So they're being kind of coy about exactly where this country is. But this campaign is what it's doing is it's collecting humanitarian aid from different sources, NGOs, governments, even private citizens like Venezuelans abroad who've been organizing in their own communities to send relief to Venezuela. So right now there's a bunch of aid. I think it's about 60 tons that's being marshaled in Cúcuta, which is a city in Colombia that's right on the border with Venezuela. And as far as I can tell, the move, they're going to try to move that into the country this weekend. So that's setting up a flashpoint because Maduro said as recently as, I think it was yesterday that Russia Today published an interview with him. Maduro said, I'm quoting directly, you know, he said, we're not beggars. We don't need this humanitarian aid. That we're not beggars. We're not taking this, you know, no thanks, right? So if Maduro orders the military to stop this humanitarian aid convoy from coming in, that's going to be a flashpoint, right? Is the army going to follow that order? Is he even going to issue it, thinking that they might not follow it? So that's what's happening next. And I think everybody's just looking to that right now and seeing how that develops. Because as I said earlier, it's a really sort of fluid situation. It's hard to tell what's going on, you know, day to day.
If Maduro was to negotiate an exit, if it got to the point where it's obvious the regime is going to completely collapse, what would the next step be? Would Guaido be a temporary president until there are new elections?
So the National Assembly has begun to move towards organizing a new National Electoral Council. So one of the reasons why we can't have presidential elections within 30 days as stated in the Constitution is number one, because Maduro just doesn't want to do it. So that, like, it's not going to happen. But also, even if he did say, even if Maduro said today, okay, yeah, let's have elections tomorrow or next week, we can't have them with the CNE. That's the name of this institution in Venezuela. The CNE has been for years completely pro-Maduro. Alejandro mentioned that the opposition won elections in 2015. And he also mentioned that I think that was the point, and I agree with him. That was the election, the parliamentary elections of 2015 were sort of like a switch went off in the CNE's head and the government's head. And they said, whatever we've been doing before to influence elections isn't working anymore. Like, we really got to go hard because our tricks aren't enough to stem this tide of discontent that's growing in the electorate. And so we saw the culmination of that in 2017 with the Constituent Assembly election, where we had this, it was an election for a Constituent Assembly, which is like the shadow parliament that the government was setting up. And after the election, so the government, the CNE announces their results and they say, I can't remember the figures, they said, you know, 8 million people voted and these were the results. And just a couple of days after, the company that provided the voting machines for the vote, it's called Smartmatic, and that had been providing voting machines for elections in Venezuela for years, they had a press conference with the head of the company saying, the election numbers reported by the CNE are not the ones that our machines counted. In other words, they just made up the results. And Smartmatic didn't say specifically what the difference was, but it was by over 1 million votes. So the government just like pulled a number out of a hat and said, this is how many people voted, right? So to my knowledge, that hadn't happened before. So now we're in a situation where that does happen. Like, there is precedent for that happening. So if there were to be an election with this current CNE, I have no doubt that they would do that. They would just straight up make up a number. So what's going to happen in terms of that? Well, first of all, Maduro has to leave, you know, ideally peacefully. I think ideally through a negotiated management, he can go to Cuba and just like live the rest of his life with peace. I think that would be the best solution. His elite also has to leave. So it's not just him. It's like a group of people. So they all have to leave. They all have to go to Cuba. They all have to live happily ever after. I think that's fine. You know, and for the sake of letting the country finally begin to heal and recover, right? And that would include the CNE. So before we have elections, we have to have a new set of institutions that will allow for them to be free, transparent, and just. And that's going to take time.
Alejandro, obviously, as the regime gets more desperate, the rate of money printing is likely to increase. And we've seen tactics where they've changed the exchange rate now. And the exchange rate, I believe, now is being tracked against the black market exchange rate. And Mauricio also commented on the fact that he thinks that there's a potential that there has been a spike in Bitcoin buying on local Bitcoins because perhaps the regime is also printing money to buy Bitcoin. What are you aware on the ground with what's happening with the use of Bitcoin? Because I checked today and I think this week was the highest volume week in terms of Bitcoin on local Bitcoins.
Yes, it's a very good question, and I wish I knew more, but I'll share the little I know. The government strategy for the past, so we have had exchange controls for 15 years, over 15 years. That means that you can't just go to an exchange house outside or inside Venezuela and just try to buy dollars. It wasn't possible. For the past 15 years, no one would take your bolívares outside Venezuela, and the government would not allow exchange houses to operate inside the country. This, of course, benefits the government, or used to benefit the government when they had a lot of oil income, and when they could decide whom to give access to cheap dollars, because this is just a mark of loyalty, or is the reward for loyalty. So if you're very loyal to the government, you never question Chavez, you can get access to multi-million dollar contracts, and you only have to pay pennies on the dollar for them. So this was a strategy for a very long time when there was a surplus and when there was oil money flowing in. But as it happens, last week we saw the enactment of sanctions against PDVSA, and then also PDVSA, which is the oil company of Venezuela. The U.S. no longer recognizes the board of PDVSA that Maduro set in place in the U.S. Like the U.S. branch of PDVSA, Citgo, these companies that belong to the Venezuelan state, since the government of the U.S. does no longer recognize Maduro, all of the republic's assets, they should be transitioned into like new management. So this is what they're a very key point of pressure, and this has made it so that the money that's effectively it's halted, that Venezuela has halted its shipment of oil to the U.S. because obviously they know they're not going to get getting paid anymore. If they do ship any oil, it will be Juan Guaido's government who will administer the sales, the revenue. So, of course, what they're doing is they're not loading the tankers anymore because they still have physical control and military control over PDVSA's assets inside the country. They're not shipping new oil, so their money's not coming in. The Venezuelan government needs dollars to operate, of course. They need to trade with other nations. They need to import gasoline or light crude to actually make gasoline in the country because our oil mostly is very heavy and we can't process it on our own. So there's a lot of goods that we import that we need to function as a country, most notably gasoline, but all kinds of foods, plastics, a lot of things. And the government, of course, is now desperate for an influx of dollars because they no longer have the revenue that they used to have. They no longer have the option to go to Wall Street, which they did many, many, many times for years at very bad rates. So Wall Street made a ton of money in trading Venezuela debt. They no longer have these options. So all they have left is their ability to print inorganic money and to try to buy assets with it. One asset that they can buy is Bitcoin. So they can, you know, get the freshly printed money before the economy realizes that there's more money and the market rate adjusts accordingly. Since they have the privilege of, you know, issuing the money and keeping it, I have this theory that some people inside government insiders are getting some of that freshly printed money and they're dumping it into Bitcoin exchanges, like, and most notably local Bitcoins because it's the one that has the biggest volume. I think it's approaching, or it has been close to $1 million a day in Venezuela for a while now. And then the other thing they can do is they can buy dollars from, try to buy dollars from people who are willing to sell dollars to the government. And before last week, this was virtually nobody, because the government had the exchange rate was, it was not favorable to someone that, that wanted to sell dollars and get bolivares. You could get a lot more in the black market, because the incentive for the government before was, oh, we're going to have this dual rate or this preferential rate for the people that we like and the people that we want to favor business with, so that they stay loyal. They have lost this policy tool now, because they just run out of money. So they need to tighten the circle and to only allow dollar or to centralize, rather, the dollars that are coming into the country, because they're in crisis mode. It's an emergency mode. So what they're doing is, okay, we're going to set, the new strategy is we're going to set the rate of the dollar higher than the market rate, so people flock to us as the sellers of bolivares. But it turns out that they do have the money printing machine that issues bolivares. So this looks similar to the start of the worst part of the hyperinflation in Germany in the Weimar Republic in the 1920s. Germany, like at that point, it ran out of things to do, like economic exports. It ran out of policy tools. The hyperinflation was just, it was bad, but it wasn't as bad. But then the government decided, oh, you know what? We could just print more money and buy more hard assets, and that'll save us. And then that is actually what made hyperinflation accelerate a lot more. And this, I believe, is what is bound to happen if the government, and it looks like it is, if we are still on this track of let's do this, people are going to very rapidly figure out that this is something that the government is doing. Like right now, it's unclear because the economy takes some time to realize, oh, this is what's actually happening. But this is a strong theory that this is what they're doing. They're trying to capture at least a significant slice of remittances, because now people who more than 3 million people have left Venezuela in the past few years. And for the first time in Venezuela in modern history, we are receiving more money. We are remittance receivers. And Venezuelan families they need to rely on their relatives abroad to be able to make a living. So since the people were using the black market before, the government couldn't capture any slice of that. But now the government has, you know, the oil is effectively not bringing in dollars into the country. The government has this new strategy of, okay, let's bring dollars by just printing money and being, you know, a seller of bolivares. But of course, this only works in the very, very short term, and it will only accelerate the hyperinflation and the crisis.
And Mauricio, you've noticed a premium on the actual dollar in the open markets, right? Can you tell us what you've discovered there?
Yeah, so I've been similar to Alejandro. My head has been in this space where I think a lot of these government officials, a close circle around Maduro, have been taking advantage of the Cantillon effect by basically getting the freshly printed batches of cash and going to dump it on the Bitcoin market. And my theory was that they would prefer Bitcoin as the sanctions escalated, because it was just censorship resistance. And so I tried to see if I could find a premium between a black market dollar and a dollar worth of Bitcoin in Venezuela. And the first time I noticed a premium was on July of last year. And I've been tracking it since. Now, mind you, the data is from black market sources. So, you know, it's not the best data, but it's the best we get. And sustained for up until today. Actually, yesterday, the premium was 17.5%. But I've seen it as high as 70%, meaning that it's almost 2-to-1 the demand for Bitcoin over a dollar. And I think this is kind of one of those first, signals that gets triggered, because really, if you dig down, why would people be wanting to pay that premium for Bitcoin? Is because, you know, it's supply and demand, right? So my guess is that the science and the evidence is starting to be there to say that these guys effectively are doing this.
I think this has been a very, very useful update for everyone. I think we've done a very good hour here, and it will make for a really solid understanding of the current climate in Venezuela. I thank you all for coming on. Just to finish off, it would be great to hear from each of you about what you think is going to happen and what you'd like to see happen over the next kind of days, weeks, and months. And specifically, Giancarlo, could you just touch on what's happening with the current state of protests? Because obviously Juan Guaido can organize protests, but at the same time, people are being shot on the streets, right? I mean, I've read reports of like 30 or 40 people have been killed. So if you could specifically also talk about that. And if you start first, Giancarlo, then we'll go Alejandro and Mauricio, and then we'll finish.
Yeah, sure. So the state of the protest today, as you said, the figures that I've seen also hover around the 30, 35 mark. I think those are accurate numbers, that range. Unlike previous protest waves, and in particular the ones from 2014 and then 2017, we're not seeing daily protests in the country. So back in 2014 and back in 2017, we had months where people were on the street protesting daily. They were blocking intersections, they were organizing marches, they were holding all kinds of events on a daily basis. What makes this round of protests different is that we're not seeing that many protests. And that, I think, you know, if we take Guaido at his word, is a deliberate move. He said during a speech recently that he said, look, we know that people have to go to work. Like, you have to, you know, we're living in a crisis. Like, people need to line up for food. Like, you have to go find the food, right? You go to a supermarket and it's whatever, there's no food there. You have to go to another one. Like, it's a big sort of deal to try to survive in Venezuela. So we understand that people have to take care of their everyday necessities and the struggle of everyday life. So we're not going to call for protests every day. So instead, what they're doing is they're calling for protests, I think, like once a week so far we've had. So we had two protest events on the weekend. We had a really short one on Saturday, and we had a longer one on Sunday. So and they're being kind of coy with announcing them. Last I heard, there was one planned for February 12th. Which is, if I'm not mistaken, Youth Day in Venezuela, and it's kind of a big sort of holiday. So I think that's probably going to be the biggest one that's coming up. And in terms of, you know, just an interesting, I think, kind of changing dynamic in the protests is that in previous waves, the repression, at least the bulk of the repression, was done by the National Bolivarian Police and the National Guard. And this year, we're seeing a lot of the repression being conducted by an organization that Mauricio mentioned earlier, the FAES, FAES in Spanish. So these guys were, the death squads that you mentioned earlier. They were created in, I believe it was July 2017, and they were involved in a security operation. It wasn't really a security operation. It was basically like roaming death squads that would go into barrios, and they would just sort of like conduct, you know, you know, they would just like extrajudicially execute people for a host of reasons, right? Some of the numbers that I've seen put the number of fatalities in those operations up to 500 killed. So those guys are much more prominent now. That's an interesting new dynamic. I don't know if that means that the government is less sure that the National Guard and the National Bolivarian Police rank and file will repress when called to do so. And they're like calling on these guys who are like death squads to do that sort of work. And then what do I hope will happen? How do I think this is gonna evolve or resolve itself? When this all, on the 23rd, when this sort of thing started to unfold and there was that initial shock of, oh my gosh, this guy just like declared himself interim president, and we didn't expect them to do that. Back then, I thought that the government was going to do something that they've been doing for a number of years, which is kind of like just ignore the opposition. So when the opposition won the National Assembly, and they started passing laws, the government just said, like, well, we're not gonna like listen to you. Like, we're not gonna follow whatever you're passing, right? So they got the Supreme Court to start declaring every law passed by the National Assembly to be like null and void, right? So I thought, well, maybe that's what they're going to try to do this time. They're just going to be like, all right, like, you want to be president, like, good luck, right? Like, we're not, all of the institutions are on our side, like the military's on our side. We're not gonna do that. But I think the Guaido and the opposition have been really smart this time, because they didn't just leave it at that. They initiated contact, diplomatic contact with other countries. They're organizing the delivery of aid, et cetera, right? So I think now it's beyond the point of the government being able to ignore it. It's like they can't ignore it. This is the reality that they have to face. I think that it's really hard for me to say. I'll tell you what I would like to see. I think the best solution was obviously a peaceful one. It's one that is managed and negotiated entirely by Venezuelans. It's something like a negotiated exit for Maduro, where the opposition sits down with him and the military sits down with him, and they say, look, our time is up. You know, we've had our fun. We need to leave. And it's over. So in that sort of scenario, you know, Maduro and the elites would go, possibly with some kind of amnesty, and then we would have the creation of new institutions that are democratic and that would allow for a transition, again, peaceful, managed and overseen by Venezuelans, to a democratic system of government. That's what I would like to see. I don't know if that's what's going to happen. I think that's the ideal scenario for me.
Alejandro?
Yes, I agree with pretty much everyone Giancarlo just said. I've always been an optimist. I want to be cautiously optimistic here. I think that we, or the opposition leaders, have been doing a great job. They have been a lot smarter this time. And I think it's very key to have the backing of the international community and people and organizations, countries, governments that do care about human rights and that are putting the pressure. I agree with Giancarlo in that this solution, whatever shape it takes, it must be led by Venezuelans, and I believe it has been so far. I think it's easy to see that there's a lot of pressure from the international community, but it's, to be realistic, this is not going to be solved without that kind of pressure. I hope that the pressure stays in that form, just pressure, and just it just manifests as a inability of the government to ignore the crisis as or the standoff, as Giancarlo just said. I think that it can still happen. We still have time. There are still things that the opposition has in its realm of possibilities. I don't think there are some people that argue that there may be violent groups that really do support Maduro and might want to start a civil war. I don't believe at this point that that's very likely, because Maduro does not have broad support, and they have very narrow economic incentives to align themselves with Maduro. I don't think there's not an ideological battle here. There aren't people that are diehard Maduro fans. There may be some. I think that we can't fully discount the possibility, but I think that if it is clear that it makes more sense economically, and it makes more sense, you know, considering how you deal with your neighbors and your community, and how this has been going on for so long. I mean, the people who support Maduro and have like been his enforcers, the civil, there's organizations that are just civilians that have access to weapons and they act as enforcers. They don't have any formal permits to carry these guns. They don't have any, they're just thugs. They're just criminals, but they enforce the government's orders. These people, I think, are what a lot of people are worried about. They're not that many, and I don't believe that they're very ideologically aligned. I think if we can make sure that they kind of get in line with the new program, you know, with, you know, let's have a national reconciliation, let's have a conversation where you can live in peace with other people, you'll realize that it's better, and, you know, in the long term, you'll also be economically better off because the crisis, it's just way better to live in a country that has institutions and that has, you know, some rule of law and democracy. We have to rebuild that trust little by little, and it's going to be really hard work, but we must try.
Mauricio?
Yeah, no, I think as far as I would like to see, I'm pretty much in line with what both Giancarlo and Alejandro said. I'm slightly less optimistic on what I think is going to happen. I've had way too many run-ins and conversations with these guys to think that they're the type that will negotiate and recognize the opposition as a democratic sovereign body. I think going back to what Alejandro said at the beginning, one thing Chavismo has done really well is polarized Venezuelan society into two classes of citizens. And I do feel they treat and have always treated the opposition as second-class citizens. So I don't, even though I would like to see a conversation happening and Maduro and his regime admitting that they will just peacefully walk away, I see that as a highly unlikely possibility. I think what's more likely to happen is, yes, he has high-ranking officers that are standing by him for circumstantial reasons for economic benefit, but no one's willing to fight for him. So I think what really needs to happen is to basically create a more real threat of actual conflict, because at that point, all of the low-ranking officers will certainly not follow orders. And once the top guys realize they've lost the ability to command the lower-ranking officers, it's just going to snowball into a transition. But I don't think it's going to be... I think if Maduro leaves, it's going to be an overnight move. I just don't think it's really likely that he's going to have a calm, negotiated exit. That's just my two cents.
Great. Well, listen, I want to say a big thank you to all three of you for coming on. I really appreciate your time. Alejandro, that's the second time we've done this, so thank you. And Giancarlo, this is the first time we've spoken. And Mauricio, this is the second time we've spoken, but I didn't link it to the first one. I wish all the best for you guys in your country, your family, and yeah, thank you all for coming on.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. It was a pleasure.
Thanks.